Damn it, Nick.
I love being on here with you guys, Nick and Joe. I really appreciate it.
Literally too long didn't read.
TLDR, you guys are awesome.
Joe, it's been a long, long time since we have talked to this gentleman, to the point where we've had at least one listener say, like, hey, isn't it about time that you had Sean Lewis back on the goddamn show? I may be throwing in some expletives there, and I may be stealing your thunder, Joe, but we have Sean Lewis back on the show today to talk about his new title. What is his new title, Joe? I'll give you that at least.
Well, I just remind myself, don't screw up the title, because, you know, I might throw an extra word in there, but it's Bear, Pirate, Viking Queen. And Sean, welcome back. Is this five times now?
Something like
that. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're approaching Brady territory. This is fantastic. Welcome.
Take it. Thanks. Thanks. It's always fun. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And we're talking Bear, Pirate, Viking Queen, which has an FOC of April 1st, everybody. You're going to want to make sure you get this. I know Sean has been tweeting about it a ton. We've been retweeting it as well. Go to your local comic shop. Give him a buzz if you have to. Let him know you want Bear, Pirate, Viking Queen issue one added to your pull list ahead of the FOC April 1st. The artist on this is Jonathan Marks. Oh, shoot.
Baravecchia.
Okay. Thank you. Hey, Joe really has been on. Like, he even corrected me on a Portuguese last name, which, like, my mother has been scolding me about for a while now. But yeah, so a quick synopsis before we get into the questions. A blood splattered story of conquest. Bears, pirates, Vikings, and queens, all battling for their claim to determine what the world will become. With 72 stunning pages, it's sure to be one of the most beautiful and thought-provoking books of the year.
I remember when we first tweeted this book out, one of our listeners, Mark. I want to call him Marcy, because he's Mark and then capital C, right? Anyways, he goes, that looks fucking awesome. And I said, yeah, it sure does. And you're going to want to read it, because it's written by, friend of the show, you know, Sean Lewis. So, like, right off the bat, when you started tweeting pictures about this, and that this was coming out, one, I knew I was going to read it because you were writing it, but two, the artwork is stunning. Where did the idea for this book come from?
Honestly, it came out of nowhere. John and I discovered we live a mile away from each other. Like, we didn't know each other. And Above Snakes was out, this Western I did with Hayden Sherman. And on Instagram, I'd been tagged on a mock-up cover by John. He had hand painted an Above Snakes cover. And I was like, you know, that's fucking amazing. And being the entrepreneur I am, I'm like, this is amazing. I got to learn who this artist is. Like, I probably want to work with him. So I messaged him and I was like, thanks for the cover, man. This is amazing. Like, you're like, where are you out of? And he was like, oh, I'm in New York. We should get together sometime. And I'm like, I'm in New York. And he was like, oh, great. And then I had to be honest. I was like, well, I'm not in New York City, just so you know, I'm in upstate. He was like, I'm in upstate too. And then I was like, well, I'm in Beacon. He's like, I'm in Beacon. I'm like, I'm lying. I'm not in Beacon. I'm in a small town next to Beacon. He was like, I'm in the same town.
What the hell?
So crazy. Like, we were both COVID movers. Like, during COVID, he moved up from Brooklyn. I moved down from, like, from Albany, Saratoga Springs area. And we literally do live a mile. There's a park. I'm looking out my window. There's a park in between our houses.
Like, oh, wow.
And so once we realized that, we got together. We went to a local brewery, and we just were like, you know, it was like a guy date, you know, where you're just like, what do you like? What comics did you grow up on? What do you like to draw? Like, we both were really into, like, old school Vertigo stuff. We find ourselves talking about Sam Keith's The Max a lot.
Oh.
I was talking a lot about From Hell, the Alan Moore book. We were talking about older books that we loved as kids. And then I was just like, something I do with most of my artists that I end up working with is I was just like, what do you like drawing? And he just started throwing out things, you know, dinosaurs. I was like, I don't know what to do with dinosaurs. And he was like, bears. And I was like, bears are dope. He was like, pirates. I'm like, pirates are dope. Vikings, they're cool too. Like, royalty, queens. I'm like, fuck, that all those things are really cool. And then we were just, honestly, we were laughing. It was like, man, what an amazing book if it were called Bear, Pirate, Viking, Queen. Like, we had no idea what it was. We were just like, that'd be, like, I would pick that book up. We were like drinking and laughing about it. And then I was like, you know, let me go home and think about it. Like, let me think if I can figure out a way to make those four things into a story. And so I did. I went away and I started thinking about, like, what possibly connects all of them? And so I started with the pirate and the Viking, and I was like, and the queen. And I just was like, oh, you know, all of us come from water in a way, like countries are set up by water, by, you know, manifest destiny type of behaviors. And I was like, all right, like I write an awesome pirate book that then transforms into a Viking book that then transforms into like a historical warfare book. Like that kind of became the impetus of like the book. And then I just started writing out like a giant epic poem, like old school Homer's Odyssey, Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and gave that to John and was like, here's your script.
Wow. That's wild. I mean, you've talked to us before. You've told us, like, I feel like with Hayden specifically, that you've talked to Hayden about like what is it that they want to draw, what stories they want to tell. And I'm like, but this feels like a whole nother level.
We had been talking about books we both loved and artists we loved, and he was sharing some books with me, like art books. I mean, John's a full on art nerd, comic art nerd, right? So he would share some like, you know, European comics with me that he was like, I would love to make a book that looked and felt like this. And I was sharing, you know, like the more literary comics I love and going like, I want to make a book that sounds and feels like this. So I feel like once we had the four words, I knew the tone of a book we'd want to make. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I was just like, I know what page we're on for what kind of comics we like and get excited by. So then it was just kind of like, yeah, how do I take these four disparate things and make a story out of them? And that's a fun challenge. I mean, I don't know. It might not be the smartest commercial decision, but each comic I've made, I'm always looking for like how it could go really bad. Like, I think there's an interesting thing with being ambitious enough to flirt with failure. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes people don't flirt with failure enough in their work. Because it's scary to fail, and it sucks to fail, and sometimes you will fail. But if you can get up right at the edge and then pull it off, it can be really amazing.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, it's like, oh yeah, what's the next title going to be? It's going to be Hookers, Blow, Ponies, and Lamps. Or
that's funny.
I would read the hell out of that.
We've been talking about doing another book together, and already I'm like, we should just keep doing nouns, man. People should just call it to the nouns.
The noun verse. Yeah, there you go.
The noun verse. Be amazing. Just do it. But I keep throwing at him. I want to do something with a samurai, but I don't know what. So we'll see.
Well, considering the art style, Jonathan's art style, I think a samurai book would actually be pretty fucking awesome.
Yeah, that'd be insane.
It'd be so gorgeous. We've been playing with that in Private Detective, and who knows? Maybe we'll mash them all up. I don't know. We're still at the beginning. We're just kind of like finally like finishing this up, but
give me a Sherlock Holmes samurai story.
I would read that. That'd be amazing.
Right?
Yeah. There you go. Holmes is the detective. I mean, a samurai as the detective would be like incredible. Any version of that would be great.
Yeah. Yeah. And you got two of the nouns out of the way right then and there.
Yeah, right there. Like detective samurai. You're right. Your listeners should write in suggestions. I'll pick through them.
Just set up a poll with just a bunch of words and see.
Just a bunch of random words. We've got two. I'll see what else we can fit in there.
So I love that. That's a hell of an origin story for how this book came to be. And I think it was the first time we had you on. You talked about sort of your introduction into, you know, writing comics and how it was sort of like, you didn't know what you were doing in the sense of like you wrote the story, you collaborate with your art and you just wrote the story that you wanted to tell and you submitted it. And, you know, it was longer, right, than the typical comic is. But it was a story that you wanted to tell. And I think what you said was like, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to write it like that, but I just, that's what felt right. And so with The Few and Bliss, and Thumbs, you tell these really, really beautiful stories, and you know, each issue is longer than your traditional comic. And then you wrote Thumbs, you start work with DC, you do a Jonathan Kent Superman for Future State, and then you get the Spawn gig, you do Above Snakes and Survival, right? All kick-ass books, go out and read them, people. But those are more traditional, right, format comics.
Yeah.
And now we get Bear, Pirate, Viking Queen, which the first issue is 72 gorgeous pages long. What was there something that happened in between that made you want to come back to sort of like telling this story in more of a Sean Lewis way, the untraditional way, or is it just how it all just kind of came together?
I mean, yeah. I mean, yes. I think when I'm doing my own books, you know, because you don't have anyone that you have to really answer to, my interest a lot of times is just like, what is it that comics can do that nothing else can? And what's right for the story? Like, it's an economic decision that makes comic books 20 pages long. Like, there's no, it's not an artistic decision. It's not like people are like, 20 page comics are the best version of a comic. Mm-hmm. And I think in a weird way that can create a weird stasis in the reader. Like books start to feel the same, and like they're the same length and they start having the same rhythms. And if people are writing a lot of books at once, there's tricks that you can lean on where you start going like page layouts and how your pages work in turn start to become the same. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. And that can be enjoyable for readers. But as a writer, I'm like, I don't know, if every movie was 90 minutes long, I'd lose my fucking mind. Like, you know, like I want to watch a shorter movie sometimes. Sometimes I want to see a 3-hour epic. So it was more of like, it's a lot of the times in my own books, I'm thinking a lot about I mean, my background's in theater. So it's like, what's the theatrical experience of holding the book and flipping through it? Like, what do I actually want you to feel by the time you end it? And John's work is like super epic. It's the best way I can describe it. Like, it's yep. just, it's really epic. And so I was like, the first issue has to be huge. Like, it has to also be epic. It has to feel as big as the arcs. If we only do 20 pages of this, I think the reader's actually going to feel incomplete. So like, and also we had a lot of talks about like how we wanted books to be, where like, I wanted each issue to be like its own standalone story that also adds to a bigger thing. And so that made it more of this kind of like, what if they're all like mini novellas, you know, that like you could pick up issue 2. And if you didn't read 1, you're like, this is a fucking dope comic. And then you go back and read 1. You're like, oh, I didn't know that's what it would be, but it totally does add to my experience of 2 and so on.
I was very curious about that. That was actually a question that I had for you, because like this issue, it's like a whole meal. And it's like, and like at the end, you know, it's like there's a to be continued, if I'm remembering correctly on that last page. And so it's like, we know there's more to this that relates specifically to this story, but it was just like, you know, we've seen with like Hotel from a friend of the show, John Lee's over at AWA Studios. Yeah. Like that is an anthology and it's all set in one place. So there's stories that don't tie together. And then we've seen other more traditional anthologies. But, and I know I've heard other creators talk about like trying to give readers a whole meal with a single issue, but I've never seen it quite done in the manner that like you did in Bear Pirate Viking Queen issue 1. So it's like, it's also what Jonathan's bringing to the table from an art style too. So that was like, when did you decide that you wanted to make it like in its own individual story issue to issue that all brings together a larger story?
I mean, I'm guessing at this. I know it happened in my living room. So it was like, it was probably midway. We had been greenlit by Image and we were probably midway through the thumbnails for issue 1. And we started talking about like, where does this go? What's the end point? Like, what's the end point of issue 1? Like, we're halfway through the thumbnails. And John had already said to me when I gave him the poem, he was like, this first issue, if it is what you gave me, it's going to be like 65 to 70 pages, which I think he thought I was going to be scared by, but I was just like, the few and thumbs are that, like, that's fine. Like, I actually think readers, if you do it well, readers are happy about it. Especially, I mean, we're only charging $4.99 for 72 pages. So
yeah,
if anyone's upset about it, it'll probably be us. But yeah, I think it was somewhere in that period that we just were talking a lot about like, what are we missing in comics? What do we want comics to be? And I was just like, you know, there's the constant push-pull between single issues that you can pick up and drop, right? That you get one and miss 3 and pick up another. Like Spawn works that way a lot of the time, right? Like you can miss some of it, catch back up, and you're in it. And then the current movement towards like these large literary arcs where like it's like 6, 8, 10 issues. And if you miss 1, you kind of are like fucked like for the rest of the series. So we were thinking... I started thinking, and John with me on it, of just like, how do we avoid that? How do we make it that like, if you miss issue 1, you're not out of this experience, that you can pick up issue 2 and just be like, what the fuck was this? and then go back and read 1 and go like, this is insane. Like I'm also kind of fascinated what it'd be like for someone to read issue 2 and then 1, because they do stand on their own, but it'd be interesting to read them in different orders.
Oh, that's that's interesting. And so how many issues are planned?
Just three. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Nice. But that's 72 pages. You're getting, that's a lot.
That's the equivalent of like a seven or eight,
the collected edition will be like 160, 170 pages.
I think. So there you go. I mean, that's it right there.
So a question, just cause I'm curious, we like TKO, for example, right. They only put out trade paperbacks.
Right.
And AWA experimented with it last year where they were going to release their Gatsby series monthly. And they pulled that back last minute and they said, no, we're going to release it all at once. And I think now Dark Horse is doing that with Dawn Runner and Ram V's title. And so with your books like Thumbs, like what I didn't read Thumbs monthly because by the time I was turned. Oh, no, I did read Thumbs monthly, actually. But some of the other books are a little bit longer. Have you ever given any thought about, telling a whole story, releasing it as a trade paperback and not doing the monthly thing?
Oh man, I'd prefer, honestly, like what Brubaker and Phillips do would be my personal dream. Like I would love to do that with Hayden. I would love to do it with Jonathan. I would do it with Kate, like the three primary artists I've worked with. If I could do a trade with them a year, like a graphic novel, I would. Part of that, I mean, just behind the curtain is it's totally economic. Like Brubaker and Phillips have such a huge following for the past 20 years that when they put out the Relentless books, they make great money. Like they make excellent money because like the audience turns out it might not be as many people buying, where like if they did Relentless as single issues, maybe the first issue would sell 50,000. Relentless, the graphic novel, probably sells half that, but they probably are making twice as much money. They're not having to deal with the drop off and the month to month schedule. Like it's a better work life for everybody to have the whole thing done. The problem is like you have to do those types of numbers, right? Like to really make it work for everyone, you need those graphic novellas to kind of be selling at least 15,000 to 20,000. You need them selling that kind of volume. And that's where it's like you need more of trust and fandom from the audience. And the publisher has to believe that that will work out that way, because for a lot of the publishers, the single issues aren't even necessarily profitable, but they work as a zero sum advertisement for the trade. Like a lot of publishers get a higher cut. I'm sorry if this is boring for your
listeners. No, it's fantastic.
Almost all the publishers get a higher cut on the trade paperback than they do on the single issues. So that's where they really make their money. So if they lose a little bit on the single issues, but it serves as just market awareness of your book, and then the trade comes out, they make that money back. It ends up working out for them. And for the creator, it's a little trickier, right? Like a lot of the times, month-to-month comics, especially independents, don't really make money. There's definitely a point where they stop, where you stop. And there's a lot of books out there that are successful and have been going for a long time that like those people aren't really making money on that book anymore. They are doing it for love, and hopefully they're making some money off the trade when each arc is collected. Month to month is hard. It's really hard.
Yeah, absolutely. It's we love the inside information when it comes to that, because we know some things, but we don't know. There's plenty that we don't know, and our listeners are on some similar level, if not know maybe a little bit less. Just because there's so many, like with the comics industry, like Joe and I were talking about it beforehand, because I know specifically I've mentioned it to you before, Sean, about the idea of like just having the first issue from the market awareness standpoint, and then going into a trade right afterwards. And in like with Dawn Runner from Ram V, it seems like that might be happening, but like kind of accidentally. I don't know for sure.
Who knows? I mean, there's a lot of different things that could inform that, like creator schedule, or how did the sales do for the first issue? Does it make sense to continue doing the printing cost of multiple months versus going directly to the trade? I mean, I've talked to other publishers who've talked about the possibility of that plan, of where they're like, we think we might do the first issue. That way collectors can get a number one, we can get market awareness, and then pivot directly into the trade. I'm trying to think. I'm sure some people have done it. It clearly hasn't become a mass movement yet, but like the industry's changing. So like, I think kind of everything's on the table right now. Like sales are kind of really unstable. Shops are having a harder time. The you know, inflation and everything else, it's all kind of hitting at once. So I think everyone's looking at the industry and going like, how do I like navigate this?
Yeah. You know? It's definitely all over the place. There's no question about that. But bringing us back to Bear Pirate Viking Queen, one thing that I was really curious about getting insight from you on. So with Jonathan, obviously his art style is not like Hayden's, is not like Caitlin's, is not like Javi's. Like it's different than anyone you've worked with previously. Yeah. And I'm curious for you from so you as you've enlightened us already, you had already talked to him. You guys already talked together, like when you started putting pen to paper. I'm curious for you, knowing his art style, did that impact how you were kind of envisioning the story as you were writing it and going through your process? And like, were you seeing things like in your mind's eye in like a watercolory kind of way? Or was it, like, I'm just curious what that experience was like.
Well, John's work is watercolor. Like that doesn't come like from me at all. Like all of the work John does is watercolor. But what I would say is like, my goal when I'm working with an artist is to look at their art and go, how do I make you a star to people who never seen you before? Like, what is it that you do that's special? And how do I kind of make it a strength? Because people can fuck up artists' art all the time by not listening to what the art's doing. It's a weird phrase, but like, there's sometimes writers will come in with such a definitive idea and they're like, just draw my fucking story. Like be a good monkey, you know? And like, and sometimes the art that comes back, they'll get mad. This happens all the time where I've had people say to me like, yeah, like I just got mad. Like that work wasn't as good as I saw it on this other book. And a lot of times I'm like, that's probably on the writer, you know, like they probably didn't realize. So with Johnny does the watercolor. And what's interesting about the watercolor is like, it's really untamable, right? Like moment you start fucking with watercolor, like all of us did it when we were in like second or third grade.
Yeah.
The worst paintings of my life were done watercolor and my mom would have to put them up on the wall. Like, and it's because you can't control it. At some point, it bleeds and it spreads. And like, John's a master at it, so he can control it more than fucking most people. But the wildness of it allowed me to go like, the story can be wild. It has to be. Like, the art is going to be untamed. So like, the story itself has to, and it's going to be dreamlike and hallucinatory. So like, me trying to do like a grounded superhero story or like a traditional like Silver Age Superman book, it would be like strange. It wouldn't read right. Like it wouldn't be the best. John can do it. John can do anything. He's a great artist, but it wouldn't be the best representation or marriage for what he does. So when I saw how big it was and how untamed and wild the colors could get, then yeah, you start thinking like, what are some situations I can create that are like amazing? The big benefit was that we live so close to each other. So it's the first time I've ever actually just been able to be in a room with somebody.
Right.
Like old school, like I grew up reading Marvel comics and reading the back pages when they talk about the bullpen, and I'd fantasize about that being my life. And so this is the first time I've actually had it. Cause like I've done 3 books with Hayden. I've met Hayden in person once, like maybe for 15 or 20 minutes at New York Comic Con. I've done 2 books with Caitlin. Caitlin, I got to know a bit better cause we did a signing tour together, but like in the process of making the book, I was never in the same space as these people.
Right.
Javi's in Spain. Like I've never met Javi. Like I've never Zoomed with Javi. We've never had a phone call. It's all by like email. So being able to sit down there with John and have him work out ideas and me throw out like, oh, I think that'll work, or seeing where his head is at, definitely helped inform, you know, ways to write for it.
I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Master and Commander, but Nick and I were having this conversation before about elevator pitches, right? And how like, They're good for that, but like sometimes when you get an elevator pitch in a synopsis, it could set someone's expectations fairly or unfairly. But as we're talking about this, and as I'm thinking about the book, I'm like, this is Patrick O'Brien meets Martin Simmons, right? Oh, yeah. Right. And so you talked about sort of this untamed, you know, aspect to the art, and there's a couple of panels there in the first issues where, you know, one of the characters is I think it's the main character, the Baron Peter,
Reddish.
Reddish, yeah, thank you. And he's talking about Tempest is coming.
Yeah.
And what the watercolor, you know, art style does for that particular panel, but the book in general, is like you think of the Tempest, you think about being out at sea, and you just think of just pure chaos.
Right.
And that is conveyed so beautifully, you know, in these pages when you're out at sea and you've got this massive, you know, storm coming. Was there something that Jonathan, like, you had this idea, right? And you're providing notes, or you're writing your script. Is there something that he came back with in this first issue that just absolutely blew your mind?
Oh, I mean, constantly. Yeah, I mean, the artists constantly blow my mind. Jonathan, especially on this book, but I mean, always. Like, there's a two-page spread where Reddish goes, I don't think it ruins anything. Like, Reddish goes from being a naval captain in the British Navy, like a captain in the British Navy, to being a pirate. Mm-hmm. And there's a spread that I think it's like 26 panels that makes up one big picture of him behind the wheel.
Crazy.
But it is the transformation. Those 26 panels make up the transformation, which is like such a gift, right? Because it's like what normally could be an entire issue of a comic book is now two pages, but done so beautifully that you get it and you're like, oh, I see it. He's a fucking pirate now. Like, and in a visually stunning way. There's also one of my favorite pages in the entire book, definitely in issue one, is like, there's a point where he's alone on the boat with the bear. And he realizes there's a fucking, the bear is on the boat, and the bear is like huge and has this burst of multiple colors, watercolor coming out.
Yes, yes.
And he's just really small, and he's just screaming like, no, 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 no. the moment, that's also gifts that you get from artists, like anyone who's aspiring writer in comics specifically. Like, it's a visual medium, and it works its best when it obviously the two have to work together and feel like they're seamless. But that's the type of page I see early on, and I go, Oh, we can fucking do that. Like, I would never, like, I'm not going to pretend. I can never imagine a panel that would look like that. I need an artist like John who does that. And then I go, oh fuck, if you can do that, now I know more of the sandbox we're in. And now I can actually be more helpful and go like, it'd be cool if we had this in a page. But I mean, with all the artists, I mean, I tried desperately in my indie work to find artists who, like, the biggest gif I can do is get the fuck out of their way. Like, and honestly listen to them more than I expect them to listen to me, right? Like, I know the story, I can change dialogue and whatnot if the panels don't come back exactly how I imagine them, but I'm not going to be able to find someone who can do that 26 panel grid that John did. Right. Like, there's only so many people to be able to do that. And it's the same with Hayden. Like, when I first saw Hayden's work, there was they all had, like, the three primaries that I've worked with, and four if you count Javi. Caitlin, her character work is unbelievable. Her acting, like, the emotion of people's eyes and how the characters come alive. That's so I know I'm writing an emotional book if I'm working with Kate.
Yeah.
Hayden is like, there's no one who's more kinetic. Like, the panels actually seem like they're animated. Like, they move, there's speed and energy. So I'm like, if I'm working with Hayden, I got an energetic book. Like I was saying with Jonathan, it's epic, right? And with Javi has just like such amazing like pencil and ink work, like traditional horror and superhero, that I'm like, anything in superhero or horror, Javi can do. So like, I know that that's where I can do that with him, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, because I don't want to take away from your writing, because your storytelling is fantastic, but this almost to me has a feel like you could put this out with almost no dialogue and still feel the grand scale and understand what is going on.
But see, I would argue that all comic books that are great should be able to do that.
Yeah.
Like that, I think people get caught in their ego too much in a form that should be somewhat egoless. Like a book just needs to, it just needs to communicate, and you usually will need, I'm not doing a great way of articulating, but like all the books that I really love, you could take all the words out and I think you would understand everything that's going on in the book and be blown away by the imagination of the artist at the same time.
Yeah, and I've heard artists say that before, like when they're drawing. I feel like I heard Greg Capullo say that before, like when he draws, like his intent is like if there's nothing, if there was no writing, you still know what the hell's going on here. But also for me, like I think one thing that we can run into a lot is narration, like just an excessive amount of narration, and like that's when it's done right. Like obviously you like it's necessary in here. Like I know what Joe said before, but like. This is a great example of where it's needed, but there are times where people just like will drone on and on about narration, and I'm just like it's just slowing me down, and I don't necessarily need it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they're all tools can be used like to a nice efficient degree or way too. Anyone who's ever seen a house can see a house that goes like they did way too fucking much, or they did too little, or that seems like a house, like right, like that looks like a nice house.
Yeah.
I feel like it's kind of similar in that way. You know, like I know writers and like, you know, when I was in school, we would have like in screenwriting, especially people would go on and on about like narration's weak. You can't narrate in your movies. And it was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Scorsese narrates constantly and it's amazing. Aaron Sorkin narrates more than anyone on earth. And like the social network is fucking amazing for it. Like, those are movies where the narration is a necessity. There's other movies where it's not at all, right? Like there's not a hard or fast rule in either case. I think it's more of looking at what you're trying to do and communicate. And then the tools should be told to you. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's just like any other art form. Like you don't want to have everything be the same. Like just like what you were talking about with the page count before and then like certain beats and everything. Like you want to have, you know, you like having like Saga. Part of what makes Saga so damn good, in my opinion, is the page turns in Saga are next level. You're not going to get that in every book, and nor should you get that in every book. And they certainly shouldn't have the same kind of like feeling as Saga does, because you're telling different stories, different pacing, and everything.
Brian's also a really great example, because like when he started working on that book with Fiona, he talked to her definitively about what she could draw, and Fiona was basically unknown. Like one of the first things she told him, like I love this story, is where she was just like, I don't know how to draw spaceships. Right. Like he was like, but they travel through space. She was like, I don't know how to draw them. And he was like, what do you like drawing? And she was like, trees. He was like, well, why can't the spaceship just be a fucking tree, which is so much better for the book.
Yeah. Right?
Like, it just makes the world so much more specific and rich. Yep. And that's the kind of magic that I think happens when you really are listening to each other and going like, this is what I like to write, or this is what I like to, you know, do. Like Caitlin was an example of that, the transformation from Coyotes to Bliss. After Coyotes, Caitlin was like, please, I don't want to draw a lot more bloodshed and violence. Like can we have more like person-to-person scenes? And that's where a lot of the scenes in Bliss started coming from, where it was like, well, we're gonna have to have like, what happens if we let them act more and really use that talent of hers? So I think that's a big part of it, is like, and I think all the great ones really, I mean, if you look at Brubaker and Phillips' work together, you can see like how in tune they are with each other.
Yeah. You know,
like page, panel by panel.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like when you see that flow, whether it's like a book that moves a little bit slower, like one we've talked about a lot recently is just Cy Spurrier's run with Aaron Campbell on Constantine, where that's got a lot of narration in it. But that also makes a lot of sense. You need that with that character, because that's a big part of the appeal of those stories. But they move at a slower pace. But then you talk about, you know, the Reckless books, and it's like, you know, those things like move at just like the fast pace, and it's perfect and everything about it. And speaking of pacing, like this is one too where, you know, you're filling us in on everything that's going on with Bear Pirate Viking Queen. A reminder for everybody, if you missed it off the top, the FOC for it is April 1st. So make sure you call your local comic shop, head in there, let them know you want Bear Pirate Viking Queen issue 1 added to your pull list. So you have, on top of it being 72 pages, just Jonathan's art style, it really like causes you to like, where Joe and I are used to definitely like, we're reading a ton of stuff because we're trying to review as many books as we can. And whatnot. And we go and read this and it's like, whoa, boy, like slow down for a second. Like you gotta take this shit in and you gotta really process it, all of it. And that is when we've talked in a few different ways, how it's unlike any other story or any other comic that you guys are going to see on your shelf, on the shelves. That's another thing that I was like, once I like did that, it was like, this is, I really am glad I slowed down. I went back started over. And it was like, this is awesome. And a big part of that too is like the way you develop this, the pirate, because I was thinking about like how, you know, like you've already mentioned it, so I'm not spoiling things, but he starts out briefly. We see him as a captain in the, in England's Navy. And then he descends into becoming a pirate for various reasons. And that's like a story. I feel like you heard about it, like you've heard like kind of in other stories, but not really fleshed out. And I know, again, you talked a little bit about how this story came to be with talking to Jonathan, but was that something that you like seen done before? And it's like, oh, like, you know what? It's not really been fleshed out, at least from my understanding before. How did you come to that idea?
Yeah. People are going to be like, this guy is just some fucking fraud. That came from my son. I got an 8-year-old son. We went to Cape.
Yes.
We went to Cape Cod this summer, and there was a rainy day, and there's a pirate museum like out on the Cape. And he was like, I want to go to the pirate museum. And I was like, all right. Like, you know, I was a great man going to the pirate museum. I wasn't excited, but it was really well done. And, you know, there's just like, you know, the little photograph, like the little things on the wall that give you like historical information. And I came across this one little square that was like, what wasn't realized is a bunch of the pirates that were hung in the Massachusetts, in the New England area, were actually former Navy people from the British, from the British Navy, who had felt disenfranchised, had fell on hard times and were poor, but they knew how to sail. They had no country. They were angry at their country because they were like, fuck, man, we've gone to war with you with the fucking Spanish. We came all the way over to this country and you just like, like got rid of us and aren't helping us. So we're going to basically like steal our pension. We're going to steal stuff back. And that I never heard. I was like, I just always thought these were like piece of shit guys who just like had like half a leg. Like I knew nothing about pirates. But when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's a pretty awesome story. The whole idea of a guy who's like in the Navy and has like a really specific life and then therefore would have a specific vision of how his life would go as an officer. And now finds himself like an outlaw, but at sea, and it's gross and it's dirty and it's, you know, like that became like, then I'm like, oh, I have a character. Like this is an interesting, there's a lot I can do here.
I love that aspect because you use that where the former captain sort of uses his knowledge of the British Navy against them, right? Which was a great scene.
And I also love stories like that. Like, oh, this is a bad analogy, but it's like the first Fast and Furious. Like, it's great that Paul Walker knows how the cops work. You know, like it helps make the movie. I love when people turn or they have the insider knowledge of how things. I like it in sports too. Like when a player gets traded and you're like, shit, are they giving like information to their opponents now?
There are definitely times where I've seen like a role player kind of guy on any team, and it's like, did they just try and acquire this guy because
for that?
Yeah, that just for that reason alone.
Certain coaches, you're always like, I think you would do that.
Signed for a week and then released after the game. Right?
They played their old team. It's like you were signed to play your old team, and now you're on the practice spot. And you're
Belichick
like,
definitely did that before.
Sure. Next 100%. Line, you should do that shit too all the time. Like. I think the AFC East was very, very bad about that. We're good about it.
Oh, very clean division. What are you talking about? No cheating whatsoever.
No cheating, no foot stuff, none of that. You know what I mean? All above board. But yeah, it's also like the fact that he's a captain amplifies that story for me too, because that's the the other thing where it's like, so we make the joke about like, oh yeah, you get this guy who like, you know, who was on the team before. Like the person I'm thinking of for some reason is like Nick Green, who played like for the Red Sox and the Braves and I think the Yankees, but like just like a, you know, a utility guy who's there and helps out. But like if he played on the Yankees before and then the Red Sox acquire him and he knows how like certain pitchers throw and whatever, like now he adds some value. This is like you're getting like Derek Jeter added to the Red Sox. Like he knows all of the closet, like what's in everybody's closets over in New York. And that's what you have here with Reddish. But that, like, for me, that like that kind of enhanced it a little bit more, because not just he knows shit, but it's like anybody can go through this kind of level of descent and go so far the other way. That made me invest even more in the character too.
I'm glad. I think he has a much further place to fall. And then it's like, what? how does he make himself a captain in his new life? You know, like what is the parallel of it?
Yeah. It's just like, it's like, as we're talking about now, it's almost like with someone who's like, you know, we'll call it like a private or whatever. I mean, that's not what, I guess you'd be in the Navy, but whatever, you have that, if you fall, like, okay, maybe you have like a small ways to fall. He has this massive way, like you said, and it's like, how do you stop yourself? Because it's like, you were so high and now it's like, how fucking low can you get? And it's like, apparently being a pirate with a bear on your ship is how low you can get.
Yeah, it's pretty low.
Yeah. And then you got other problems too. But
99 problems, but a bear ain't one.
Look at that. Now, we did want to talk to you. There is another title that you got coming out. It's going to be shortly after Bear Pirate Viking Queen comes out. We don't know the FOC date on it, but make sure you guys let your local comic shop, when you call them and say, or go in and say, hey, Bear Pirate Viking Queen, add it to the list. And you got to do it before April 1st. Make sure you mention Monolith as well. That is Sean's latest Spawn title that's going to be coming out. Of course, we've talked with you in the past when you started your King Spawn run and your run on the Scorched as well. I mean, Joe and I absolutely loved it. I know King Spawn, that run ended July. The Scorched was October. Right. We got this other story coming out, and obviously with you and Javi, and then Steven Segovia as well. We talk about different art styles too. His like, and I'm blanking on who did the colors for you guys, but it was like
Efco Palencia.
Okay, very clean, like just like it's such a different vibe. But you know, like Joe and I, like especially someone who loves Spawn, you know, ever since I first read it, it's an understatement to say that we absolutely loved your work on it. It's like, you know, and we didn't want to see, we weren't happy to see it coming to an end either. And I know it's been a little while for you since your run ended with those two titles. And obviously, again, you still got Monolith coming. I'm assuming you've had some time to like reflect on the whole experience. I'm just curious what like some of your major takeaways are.
I mean, it was fun as hell. I mean, like writing Spawn, like writing in that universe is a lot of fun. I learned a lot, you know, about, I mean, I think also just like, I'm sure it influenced having a comic named Bear Pirate Viking Queen. Like Todd's incredible at marketing. Like Todd is like, I don't know that there's anyone better in comics at getting people to know about your comic than Todd, like at all. And I think I learned a lot in terms of, you know, I did that right after doing Future State. Future State was the first time I did anything that was like a traditional commercial book. And I think I learned so much more about making a book in that world on Spawn by far. And I got to work with Javi and Steven Segovia. And like, I mean, there's also like, this is one of, I mean, I have no idea what the plans are. Like I've been pretty removed for a little while. I'm working on Bear Pirate and some other outside projects, but like, I know I wrote more than, I know that I have or am writing more than one of mini series. Like Monolith is one thing I've written since King Spawn within the Spawn universe.
Gotcha.
Like that team is always kind of like figuring out and maneuvering like where things are going to go and when or how. So like, there's some other things that I'm like, I know I just finished that up. I have no idea.
Oh, damn. Yeah. They seem like they have, that there's a lot going on there. I know there's other new titles that are coming and whatnot, but for Monolith, for us, like, I mean, that's obviously this character is just this gargantuan, massive character. And again, this is coming out on May 15th. And you're working with Valerio. Geez, we should ask beforehand. Gian Giordano.
Yes. Good. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. Valero's amazing. Valero's artwork is, Valero is also working on, which one is it? I'm one of the new Mark Millar books.
Oh, okay.
It's one of the big ones that's coming out at Dark Horse in a couple of months. I'm completely blanking on the name.
I don't remember any of the titles getting announced other than like the stuff that he'd done at Image previously that's now going to get released over at Dark Horse.
It might be that Valerio just told me about it.
Oh.
I know that Valerio is working on
cool.
Valerio's I mean, I don't give a shit. Like, you should buy it. It's Mark Millar and Valerio. He's doing Nemesis over at Dark Horse with Mark.
Oh, wait a minute. No, that was out there.
Very comfortable with
it. Yeah, you're good.
I had a moment where I'm like, oh, shit.
That's what we do. Hey, we lull you,
lull you to sleep. Yeah, like, no, you want to hear a good story about who's working?
Yeah, I sure do.
Yeah, Valerio's an incredible artist. So yeah, Todd and Thomas Healy, who's the editor over in the Spawn universe, were just like, do you have an idea for a monolith story? This would be the artist. They sent me Valerio's art, and I was like, yes, I have some ideas of what we could do together. Nice. And so that kind of launched that off. And yeah, that book is a big nuts cosmic B movie. Like it's got some Planet Hulk in it. It's got some it's basically getting into the origins of like him and Omega before Omega Island became a thing around 300.
Okay.
So it's like, how did we get there? Who are they? And how did Monolith end up on Earth as well? But with like a lot of fucking brutal scenes to get us there.
Oh, that, awesome.
That's saying something, because we've seen some brutal things from your work on Spawn. Oh, yeah.
I'll just say there's like the first issue takes place in an intergalactic prison that Monolith has to fight his way out of. So it's pretty violent.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of like seeing violence in your work, I mean, King Spawn is like what jumps right to mind for Joe. In Bear Pirate Viking Queen,
yeah.
There's something that happens later on in the story, you know, not getting into spoilers, that was like so fucking badass. Like I think you know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's like, God damn, that's just gonna stick with me from that book for sure.
I mean, it's one of the most fun things of writing a Spawn book is like any aggression you have from your day, it's like there you go, Al. Like, Al, go for it.
With King Spawn, I think both Nick and I were taken a little aback because we hadn't seen any announcement that your run was ending on that book, and we were pretty stunned. Where you stopped writing King Spawn, how much more of this like of your story was left to tell with that series? Because Nick and I were absolutely loving it, and I wanted to know how Sean Lewis's story for King Spawn ended, and we didn't quite get that.
Sure. I mean, well, I guess I would start by saying like the it's always Todd's story. So like that's how I would basically start with it. There's definitely some things there's a lot of things I wanted to do, partially because like my fascination with Spawn, with Al Simmons specifically, was like, you can do any kind of book with that character, and you can't really do that with anyone except Batman, meaning like, if you want to write a war book for an issue or eight, you can write a war book. If you want to write a horror book, a detective book, a superhero, a pure superhero book, you can kind of do anything. So like there was definitely a lot of things that I was thinking about and wanting to do. There was a lot of the talks going into like building up towards 350. But I mean, it comes down to the matter of like, I mean, it's Todd's toy, and Todd wanted to come back and write. Like it's really like there's no real hard feelings. It just kind of like came to that. And I think there was always a kind of understanding that that was going to happen at some point, you know? So like it was a lot more, I didn't know when it would happen, but I mean, also in general, like no comic book writing job is forever.
Right. No. Yeah. 24 issue run on one title is a long ass time.
And when the original founder and creator still writes and works and edits on all the books, you're like, yeah, this is where this is going to, you know, eventually this is what we're going to do. You know, I knew it was Scorched because I talked to Thomas about that I wanted to get through the Planet Eaters and like the more cosmic intergalactic stuff, because that was going to, we had started talking about the miniseries. And so I knew that was going to feed into Monolith. And I was hitting a point with that where I was just like, you know, I think this will be a good time for me to move. And then, yeah, then with King Spawn, I was just like, you know, Todd wants to come back. It was just like, yeah, you know, that's what it is. But then I moved, like I said, directly into the miniseries. This one, there's another one, there's a one shot, there's two one shots that I've been worked on. And yeah, you know, I'm always going to fantasize about all the different places I could do that. I mean, I'm sure I'll bother Todd and Thomas at different points of like, I would love to do graphic novels in that universe. Like that, like if I could do some Elseworld Spawn like type novellas or graphic novels with some of those artists, I'm like, that would be pretty amazing. Cause then I think it'd be really fun to go into, you know, a war book, like doing, you know, Punisher Born, but with King Spawn, you know, like that type
that's
of stuff.
Brilliant.
I'm fascinated by.
That's brilliant. Like the larger idea of doing like novels, like off the rip with Spawn.
I think it would work great. You know, like it would be very different than what they've done though. And what they've done has been very successful, you know? So but it's something that I learned a lot from it. It was really fun to do. Look, writing comics is a fucking present. So like the opportunity to always do more on something that you're enjoying, I would have been happy to, but I'm also really happy about what I got to do.
Yeah. So, I wasn't sure if you had like a specific ending, you know, if there was going to be like a finality to that particular, you know, title.
I mean, there's definitely some that were in my head of like things I wanted to do with Wanda, but that also becomes a negotiation, you know, and that's a conversation. That's also something you have to take in as you're doing the books, right? Like it's never going to fully be like exactly what I want. Like I might want to bring Wanda back. Todd might not. And then that's not going to happen. And nor should it. If like, again, it's like, if I was in Magnolia's, if I was writing Hellboy, it's going to really be at the end of the day what Magnolia wants it to be, you know? And same with Lemire and Black Hammer's universe. Like, and that's how it should be. Those people worked incredibly fucking hard to make those like things. Right.
Happen. And I guess that's easy for someone like myself to kind of forget at the end of the day. Right.
Yeah. Well,
I know it's Todd McFarlane's Spawn, but I'm reading Sean Lewis's King Spawn and, you know,
No, and I get that. And I appreciate that. I've had a lot of people say that to me, which is incredibly flattering. I mean, when I took that job, I was honestly, the main thing I can say now that I didn't then is like, I was scared, like in a way, because I was just like, this is a book that was like when I was a teenager and when so many people were teenagers, they grew up with. And if it gets fucked up, it's going to be remembered. And at the same time, I'm like, all my heroes wrote runs of books that you point to. And I was like, I would love to be the guy who wrote a Spawn run that you point to.
Yep.
So that was really the goal. And, you know, I'm pretty self-critical. Like I wouldn't say the whole run pulls that off. I'm very, very proud of it. I think the first 12 issues, I'm incredibly like proud of like what we accomplished, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, I also learned a lot because like the schedule of monthly comics throw crazy curveballs at you that I never expected. Like, and not bad. It really kind of taught me to do things that I would never feel comfortable before, where you're suddenly like, we're going to press in 2 weeks and we don't have all the art. We've got like 10 pages. Like, can you come up with a way that we can make this book work? And suddenly you have like, people remember there's like some issues where like it's 2 10-page stories. And sometimes that's a kind of like last second, like how do we make this thing fucking work? Which is an interesting math, you know, but it brings out, I think sometimes those things are great though, because they shake up what you got comfortable with. And then you make something interesting out of it. And then that gives a new jumping off point and on and on and on.
So I'm curious, like, cause we sometimes get into nuts and bolts stuff with people, but we do more so with you. So when it comes to the month to month stuff, like month to month writing specifically, cause like with Bear Pirate Viking Queen, you could write the whole thing and then just and give it to John and then you go from there.
Yeah, for the most part, did you know?
So there you go. So what is like for this for you? Like, what's the like kind of the beats of your schedule when you're dealing with a major monthly book like King Spawn?
Different writers will have different answers to this. My experience of this and any other month to month I've done so far has been that like you kind of bank the first arc. You're probably like 3-4 issues in when the artist starts the first issue. You're usually on like really on schedule for a little while, and then it becomes a month to month book for both you and the artist. Drawing comics is fucking insanely hard. Like, it's an absurd. I'm amazed by everyone who's able to do it. I'm dumbfounded by people who can do it on a monthly schedule, because that's even a manipulated schedule, right?
And then there's Dan Mora.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, when people even say month to month comics, what you're really talking about is like 3.5 weeks, not even 4, because you've got to turn it into editorial and to the publisher and the printer, right? Like, it has to go through all of that in that last week. So art's not being drawn, like it's being approved in that week. So like you might on the very tight times get like a page or two in, but there's a cutoff at a certain point where the printer's like, we're not printing your book. It's going to get moved a week. And then the release date gets moved and no one wants that. So that's where it can get really tricky. And it's amazing the people who are incredibly good at it, because you do start to hit points where like things you planned very specifically might have to change, you know, just because of how the schedule is falling, or like also everyone has lives. So like there's a death in a family. There's someone's internet goes out for a week because there's a tsunami, like things that happened, you know, where like you're suddenly like, we don't know when colors are coming in because this happened in the Philippines where the colorist is, or this is happening with Javi. Javi was traveling for a con and got caught, like there was a huge storm. So now he's stuck in Frankfurt. Like, and okay. So you're kind of catching this type of stuff in real time. And this is all writers and artists. Like there's also, you know, writers get caught doing shit too. Like life happens to them as well. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting thing because like you are kind of married into this, like every 3.5 to 4 weeks, we're turning in a 20-page book that we have to believe is good enough to put their money into. And we're hoping that life and everything else doesn't interfere with it. And it does. It at some point does. So,
and we learned from Tony Fleece that if you draw a certain part of the human anatomy, there's certain printers in the United States that won't print it, and you got to ship it up to Canada.
That's 100%. Certain body parts, there's certain levels of violence that some printers will not print.
Did you run into that with Kingspawn 1?
I'm sorry?
Did you run into that with the first Kingspawn?
Not that I know of. I don't think we had any. I think the only problem we ran into with Kingspawn 1 is we just had to print so many books. Like so many. But literally, I think more than anyone expected. Like, I remember talking to Todd the day that happened. He was like, oh, shit. I was like, what? I thought you'd be really happy. He's like, I'm happy, but that's a lot of fucking books.
Well, it was that fucking good. But like so now we know, like we've got like we're kind of figuring out that line in the sand, Joe. Like you can blow up a school filled with children, but you can't send butthole pics. Right. That's
pretty fair. Sure. I think for a lot of publishers that would be probably true.
There you go. But everybody now we all know. We all learned this one together. So thank you for closing the loop on that one, Sean.
I'm happy to.
One last thing, because I you said this earlier, like going back to, you know, Bear, Pirate, Viking Queen, you talk about Jonathan's art style and how like it fits this story really well, but you couldn't like do a superhero book with it. It'd be weird. I will say this though, I would love to commission him to do a Spawn watercolor.
I would love, when I talk about doing an Elseworld Spawn, I would love to do a book with John. I feel like a painted book of Spawn
would be wild.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be stunning.
Yeah.
I can picture in my head in a lot of ways just like what that would operate like, and it would be, I think it'd be really special.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be really cool. Yeah, I'm really hooked on this Elseworlds idea now. Now you've got me all excited.
So. I think it'd be super cool. You know, it's a big undertaking though. I mean, they're already, I think there's like going to be 12 new books, like 9 new books this year.
It's crazy.
So it's I'm insane. Like, I don't know if they're going to be like, yeah, we'll take on graphic novels too. I think that'd be a great, because Thomas is the lone editor. I want him to live. I think it would
be awesome. I want him to live. Yeah. Well, you can't live without good story, Sean. Well, so just give him a good fucking story.
I mean, he's got four books already nattying, I think at least 8 or 9. So you're talking about a 13 book schedule. That's
insane. That's insane. Yeah. and I did want to ask like one last thing on Monolith. So you kind of gave us an insight onto the whole like origin story and how it's cosmic planet Hulk a little bit in there and everything. That sounds great, because I was going to ask you about that. When it just in general though, like writing this character, like it sounds like you were presented with the opportunity to write about this character. But why did you want to write more about Monolith?
Well, there wasn't much about him at all. You know, like I got really fascinated during the Kingspawn run and the Scorched run of getting to write characters that nobody had a preconceived idea of. Mm-hmm. because the characters have been around forever. So it's like how much room you have to actually forge who they are is minimal, right? Like you can't really have Al suddenly is like, you know, running a pet shelter. It'd be like, you know, like some, maybe he would, but I don't know how to do that.
That's your Elseworld story. There you go.
That's the whole book. Just him and puppies. So I think that was the thing. I dug Monolith when I was working on Squished. I was, you know, you fall in love with certain characters. I was just really digging this like brutal Hulk character who just had a huge sense of duty, but not a necessarily love for his teammates or the people he was protecting. Was interesting to me. Is like, he just seemed to me as this guy who, this character who just was like, I fucking crush things. I destroy them. I'm really brutal. If people die, that's unfortunate. I'm protecting them also. I'm kind of cast into this. And that I think is interesting because there's always something more there. So then in the miniseries, it allowed me a chance to go like, what does affect this thing? Huh. Right? Like what actually does get at him and makes, you know, cause like Todd did a great job with the setup with Al, right? Like, everyone turned on him and he lost his wife and never got to have a family. Like, you know, you get why it's this never ending vengeance. With Monolith, it's like, why the fuck does this guy do anything? Like, you know, so it allowed kind of going into that and going like, all right, who is this character in this universe?
I did feel that, like, oh, he's this cool looking character. You get all these other characters who, like, you know, have been fleshed out in various ways. So it's like, okay, we just had this cool looking character and he's a beast and everything like that. But I'm like, I don't know what his deal is, but he's cool. So now I'm looking forward to having you flesh this character out a little bit more.
Yeah, it's fun because, you know, and it ends up being then the narration and dialogue, you get his point of view finally. Because, like, even in Scorch, it's not really through his point of view. I mean, at least when I was writing it, it was so much really a Jessica book.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, it was really getting her point of view for most of the story.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so Bear Pirate Viking Queen. FOC for this is April 1st. And when you go in there too, let them know, hey, you want Monolith as well? Add that to your pull list. They're both coming out in May, but the FOC for Bear Pirate Viking Queen, we know, is April 1st. So get to your local comic shop, let them know you want this and add it to your pull list and you'll be all set. You will be happy. And there's also plenty of other books from Sean. If you like one Sean book, you're going to like them all, quite honestly. Most recently, besides the Spawn stuff, is Survival over at Dark Horse. We've talked about a ton of his other titles as well. Bliss, The Few, Thumbs.
Above Snakes.
Above Snakes. That was the last time we talked with you, Sean.
Yes.
It was Above Snakes. Absolutely. That's what it was. Yes. Awesome. Loved Above Snakes too. That was actually you. So that book was the first time that I at least knowingly read a book that featured Hassan.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And he's fucking everywhere now.
Oh yeah. 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 He's a machine.
Busiest man in comics. My God. But anyways, thank you so much for taking the time, Sean. And we'll catch up with you again. Hopefully it won't take as long between the conversations.
Just let me know. I'm around.
Thank you very much.
I like Nick's just like, I'm out. All right, we're done.